Shalom Aleichem, Chaver Gemar Chassim HaTov. This is Binyamin Hammer at the National Council of Young Israel. We welcome Rebbe for conference call number 67. Thank you, Rebbe.
Thank you. Question one. A young woman in our shul, age 36, with severe anxiety manifested, among other things, as a feeling of chest pain and tightness and pain in the left arm. Has an appointment for a cardiologist after Yom Kippur, but just as a precaution, probably anxiety symptoms. Fasting causes severe reactions, including feeling faint and about to pass out, also probably anxiety-driven. She fasted on Tisha B'Av and was unwell for days afterwards. She is terrified of fasting on Yom Kippur. How should I guide her? Well, these are medical issues. We are taught that medical issues are decided by doctors. She should go to a doctor before Yom Kippur. I'm not sure she should go to a medical doctor or a psychiatrist. I'm not sure what kind of doctor she needs, but you need a doctor. If after going to whatever doctor she's supposed to go to, she still feels that she may faint and pass out, that is pikuach nefesh, and she has to eat to avoid a pikuach nefesh situation. But just the plain anxiety does not rise to the level of pikuach nefesh. It's not clear from the question, what does it mean unwell after Tisha B'Av? The Rav has to pass in basis of what the doctor says. Whenever you're in doubt and you don't know, so of course we have to err on the side of caution. As Reb Chaim of Brisk used to say, he's not a makel in the laws of Yom Kippur, he's a machmir in pikuach nefesh. Beyond that, every case has to be treated individually. Question two. Does an avil who was in his shana after the loss of a parent attend Yizkor? So if you look on the Sefer Divrei Sofer, he quotes us, some say no, and some explain because the mace is not forgotten till after 12 months, or end of brachas, and therefore it will lead the person to cry and to scream, and everyone will get all confused. That's why he should not say Yizkor the first year. Some say that Yizkor really means that Hashem should remember us for schus in the schus of the nifter. But the first 12 months, it's impossible because the nifter must fend for himself, presumably based upon the chazal that the mishpat is yud beis chodesh. Those are the two reasons which are given not to say yizkor. Some say, if you don't say yizkor, there's no need to leave. Usually we leave someone who's both parents leaves. Should be an ayin hara, but if the parent is lost, if you don't say yizkor, according to some, you need not to leave. And some say you should say yizkor. Some say after 30 days, some say even after 7 days. If there's no minhag kavua, I believe that the person can do what he or she pleases. I don't think there's anything terrible about either saying yizkor or leaving for yizkor. Question three. The chassan in Shana Rishona wear kittel on Yom Kippur. So the Nitei Gavriel, he has two reasons not to say to wear a kittel. One is based on an assumption that it says in the Mishnah, Ben Shmon Esher Lechupa. So if you get married at age 18, the first year you're still for sure under the age of 20, and therefore under 20, number one, cannot be compared to a malach, and the kittel is like a malach, it doesn't apply under 20, or a kittel is to remember the day of death, and under 20, bezin shomala does not judge. That's reason number one. That reason does not apply in our part of the world. No one gets married before the age of 20, almost no one gets married before the age of 20, so if that's the reason, we should wear a kittel. A second reason is that a kittel is to demonstrate humility. Again, presumably because it's a Yom HaMisa. Humility. And the first year of marriage, a person should be cheerful. V'simech as ishto asher lokach. Or on the other hand, since he already got married in the past year and he already put on his kittel when the day of his wedding, there's no need for another wearing of the kittel to remind you to do tshuva on Yom Kippur. Those are reasons that are given for those who do not wear a kittel. Others disagree with all these reasons and say you should wear a kittel. So once again, if there's no minute kavua, a person can do what he thinks is right. Question 4. Is it permissible to use the Norelco one-blade shaver? Now, we have a cloud with names of shavers. The name is used for advertising purposes and does not necessarily reflect the truth. It's not one blade, it's two blades. The same as the lift and cut that's supposed to have the blade officially touch the skin. It's not true. When it came out, someone I know sent two letters to Norelco years apart. It came back with the same answer, that there's no blade that touches the skin. To my knowledge, the same thing is true with respect to the so-called one-blade Norelco shaver. And therefore, those who feel it's permissible to use a shaver in general, there are many who think that any shaver is no good. But if you assume that a shaver is good, it seems to me that this shaver would be good as well. And there are some rabbanim who distinguish between one kind of shaver and another, and they try to dull the blades a little bit. That's a legitimate position in halacha, but quote the most, I think either it's they're all us or they're all mutter. And those who are not to shave can use this shaver as well. Question 5. In our shul, we publicly ask at the end of Musaf if anyone's going out of town in the coming week. To those who are, we give a tefillas adera card. The shul is within an Erev, but not all the attendees live in the Erev, and most of them are not Shomer Shabbos, so they could end up carrying the card all over town. Is this Lifna Iver? Should our practice be discontinued? It's not Lifna Iver. They can carry it or not carry it on their own. It's like Chad Ever Denara. They can, it's up to, totally up to them to do whether they're going to take it or carry it or leave it behind if they pass the Erev line. So therefore, there's no Lifna Iver in the strict sense. There may be a problem that's called Mestayel de Ovri Avera. That may not apply to those who are not Shomer Shabbos. If you look on the Shach and the Dogon Meravav and Yerodeh Simen Kuf Nun Aleph, these are a tam that we use in a pinch. It seems to me, though, that there's not such a great need to give out Tfilas HaDerech. It's a bigger problem to Chashash Chilul Shabbos than the upside of Tfilas HaDerech. So I think it's better this, if there's no problem, it's better that they should not do this and give out the Tfilas HaDerech some other time. Question 6. At what point should one make a bracha leisha basuk on food before or after birchas hananin? Does it matter if it's bread or mazonos? B, if one is eating a large sunan cholam or tzukas, meat and vegetables, should he eat bread so as to be obligated in the bracha of leisha? Okay. We make the bracha after birchas hananin. That's, A is easy. B is much more complex. It relates to A, the matter of it's bread and mazonos. Doesn't matter in terms of when you make the bracha. It's always afterwards. After the bracha, then you make leisha basuka. But it's not clear that you make a bracha of leisha basuka on mazonos. Because within mazonos, not every mazonos is chayiv and sukkah. There's certain disputes. And therefore, it's not completely clear. That's what B is also raising that question. Should you eat bread to get out of the suffix brachas of leisha basuka? You know, if you know for sure that you'd be potter from the bracha, I would say, you're not mechuyev to put yourself into a situation to make a bracha. You can very well do the mitzvah without a bracha. You're not mechuyev. However, since it's a suffix, a big meal with meat and vegetables, according to some posts, we really should require a leisha basuka, because it's the kind of thing which we only eat in our regular dining rooms. We only eat it on the road. If you look on the Rit from the Sech Tasukah and other sources, so therefore, to avoid a situation of suffix brachas lahakol, maybe it's kedai to wash as long as you are hungry and you would like to eat bread. Some say lechatchila is a mitzvah to eat pas on chalamayid every day laila v'yom. That's quoted in the Mishnah Berurah, Siman Tov Kuf Lamed, end of Sifkot Nalef, and the Shaar Tzion Sifkot Vav. To me, it's a problematic. If you look at Shaar Tzion Sifkot Dalet, seems to say the reverse. Especially nowadays, most people, many people, don't wash, don't eat bread from Shabbos to Shabbos. So to impose this lechatchila obligation, which seems to be very questionable, that whether it exists in the first place, it really cannot be imposed. But again, if a person likes that bread and wants to avoid a suffix of Leisha B'Sukkah, it can't hurt. Okay, question number 7. What is the Nekudas HaMachlokas regarding brushing teeth on Shabbos? What is the best thing to do L'maisa? If one held like Rav Soloveitchik on this issue, would he be obligated to follow the Rav's other P'sakim on Shabbos? The answer to the second question is absolutely not. There are many Machlokas. If you hold like one rabbi on one issue, it doesn't obligate you to follow the rabbi on every single issue. What's the best thing to do L'maisa? L'maisa, we try to follow the strict opinion in all these cases. If one has to brush teeth on Shabbos, which dentists say you should do, and somebody should have to floss also on Shabbos, those who floss, you're allowed to do these things on Shabbos, as long as it doesn't cause bleeding. It's a psych ratio to cause bleeding would be a serious problem, so if you have better health, dental hygiene, it would not cause any bleeding, and therefore it would be okay. The brush should not be wet before you use it, because that would involve the problem of schita. But the Nekudas HaMachlokas to which the question refers is about the toothpaste. Is there an Easter of Memachek? Rav Moshe has a very brief tshuva. Or Chaim Chelek Alef Siman Kuf Yud Beis. He says it's a question of Memareach, a told of Memachek. Something is being spread. And Rav Soloveitchik disagreed. I spoke to Rav Shechta Shlita, who was in the Shia 60 years ago when Rav Soloveitchik spoke about it. And his recollection is that he thought it was okay, and someone raised his hand and said that Rav Moshe prohibited it, and he asked why. And so the answer was given that the advertising says that there's a thin film which remains on the teeth for a long period of time, and that's why it would be an Issur B'Mareach. So the Rav asked, do you believe this advertisement? We already spoke before not to believe advertisers. I myself remember that advertisement when I was a child. And he said, even if you believe it, they tell you it's invisible. So if it's invisible, it doesn't count. This is how it was said in the Shia by the Rav many years ago. Rabbi Avadja has a different take on this in Yabia Omer Chelek Dalet Siman Chav Zayin, where he's worried about the a visible film of the toothpaste on the teeth as soon as you finish brushing your teeth with the toothpaste. However, he's matter on the ground that as soon as you've finished it, you rinse your mouth and it disappears. And he says it's not even an Issur D'Rabbanan. In such a case, he proves it from Magen Avraham and from other sources as well. Again, the best thing to do is to be strict. Some talk about toothpaste as maybe it's a refuah. Some say it's not a refuah because it doesn't really do anything medically, despite what the advertisers say. Well, if it's not a refuah, then you don't need it. You can do without it. It may make it a little bit more pleasant, but it's better to brush your teeth with a dry toothbrush without toothpaste. That's the best thing to do. Question 8. What about breakout shul kiruv activities that take place during the service? Is there a hetzer to miss the haftorah to the end of Shacharis? Could a frum person also attend? I did a little homework. There are apparently many different kinds of breakout services, kiruv activities. It seems to me that for the Baal Tshuva, who knows nothing, it's certainly mutter. For the one who's responsible for conducting the breakout service, it's certainly mutter. That individual should try to daven Ashkama in the community so he can not miss the full Tefillah B'Tzibur, even when he's going out later to conduct this breakout service for beginners of Baal Tshuva. For the rest of the shul, the frum, what they call over here, the frum purple in the shul, who don't need this breakout type of service for Kiruv, they should stay in shul. Should not be porish min hatzibur in the middle of the davening. Especially by the haftorah. Because by the haftorah there's this terrible, terrible practice called kiddush clubs, which is so pervasive in certain parts of the world. They leave by the haftorah, come back just before musaf. They miss the haftorah, they miss the rabbi's drasha, and they unfortunately often drink alcoholic beverages, it's a churban. So no one should walk out for haftorah for any cause whatsoever. It shouldn't be confused with kiddush clubs. But once again, breakout services are very good for Bali Tshuva. And they can leave, of course, and the person who's conducting can leave, but everyone else should stay. Question number 9. They want grilled food on Yom Tov. They want grilled food on Yom Tov. And with the gas grill, and then turn off the gas when done. It's a serious problem, because kibui on Yom Tov is not allowed, unless you're lowering the flame in order to cook and it shouldn't burn the food. But turning it off completely, that's not called ochel nefesh, and it would not be allowed. I would say that if a person has no choice but to use the grill to prepare the Yom Tov food, we would have to find a goy to turn it off. It's called a shvus to shvus. But we try to avoid shvus to shvus lechatchila, and therefore, if you don't plan to leave the fire on the whole Yom Tov, it's better not to make a grill Yom Tov in the first place because of the problem of kibui. Question number 10. What is one allowed to do on Shabbos Yom Tov when a bee comes into the sukkah? They want to trap it or kill it. Does it make a difference if someone is allergic to the bee stings? Are there any dishes with killing a bee on a weekday? On a weekday, you're allowed to kill the bees. So it shouldn't sting you. That's certainly permissible. If someone has an allergy, that is a pikuach nefesh. And then you can kill the bee for sure. This is found in the Sefer Shmir Shabbos Kol Chosa, Perek Chofei Sif Aleph, based upon doctors saying it's dangerous. There's no danger, since the sting causes significant pain. It's permissible to trap the bee. This is again found in that same Perek and Shmir Shabbos Sif Beis, based on Simon Shin Tez Zion Siv Zion, the Mishnah Berurah Chav Zion. The din of Yom Tov is the same as Shabbos, Simon Tov Tzadik Zion Sif Alpha, the Debi Alocha there. And therefore Sukkah, which is Yom Tov, there's also a Shabbos too, but most is a Yom Tov, have to follow the guidelines. If someone is allergic, should kill the bee. If no one is allergic, should trap the bee. This is what should be done. Obviously, we try to avoid being with star because of the bees, but we have to follow these guidelines. Question number 11. What about a canvas sukkah? The loved straps help. Well, it's complicated. You have to look at Shulchan Aruch Siman Tov Reish Lamed Sif Yud, and also in Hilchos Shabbos. Siman Shin Samach Bei Sif Alef, according to most poskim, the laws are identical. It's not only Beruch Metzuya, we taught it's no good. How do you define that? Is a big machlokes. According to the Chazon Ish, as long as the canvas, while it blows, is always tied down and is always in the right place, even though it moves in the wind, it's still kosher. Other poskim disagree strongly and say, no, if it moves, doesn't matter where it moves. As long as it moves anywhere, it's considered to be possible. I mean, it doesn't mean a mashu, it means noticeably moves, it's already a problem. And that's going to be a problem with canvas sukkahs. Even if you tie them down in all four corners, they likely do move. It depends, of course, how big the canvas is and how heavy the canvas is. We are basically on what we call a ruach metzuya, not a hurricane. But most canvases will blow significantly even in a ruach metzuya. And therefore, according to the Chazon Ish, it's presumably good. According to the others, it's much more of a problem. Although Rav Sternberg is quoted as saying that in Moadim Azman Mechelik Alasim and Pei Dalid, that if it blows the knot on the bottom, does not detach. The Shulchan Aruch, when he says it's no good, he's fearful that the knot on the bottom will detach and it'll simply flap in the wind. So based on that, Rav Sternberg writes that as long as it's in fact attached to the ground, attached to the side, and does not become detached, even though it moves a little bit, there is some room to be lenient, as long as it's attached well. That's along the lines of the Chazon Ish, not exactly the same. Some suggest if it's within love, it blows less than 3 tefachim, which is almost all of them. It would not be a problem. Not everyone agrees to that either. So therefore, it's better to use the lovered strips. What are lovered strips? The Shulchan Aruch there says if you have parts of the mechitza that are jammed into place and they don't move, that's okay. So if you had 10 tefachim high in the following way. Every 2.5 tefachim is a strap, but the strap is very tightly strapped and doesn't move in the wind at all. So you have 4 of them, 2.5, 5, 7.5, and 10, then that's a kosher mechitza by itself. Now, we don't want to use such a mechitza, we use the canvas, but in case the canvas fails the criteria which we spoke about earlier, you can rely on the lover straps. That's the basis for this halacha. Are bamboo mats acceptable? That's a great question. I just spoke about it on Shabbat Shuvah in my shul. Very, very, very complicated. Most of the literature you'll find about it is on some of the details. Number one, if it's made for a shade, a mechitza, is it good or no good? Remotions of Venetian blinds are no good. And Rabbi First in Chicago said that the Home Depot fence is good because it's attached to the ground. And there's a discussion of other things which are made for fencing and shades. That's issue number one. Then some say there's a problem called Gzeiras Tikra of Nesarim, that if you have many little slats and they're all tied together, it's a problem, and some extend that prohibition to the sukkah mats. Others are worried about the Dover HaMaimid in the threads that keep the pieces of the sukkah mat together. Others are worried about Gzeres Chavila. If there's more than 25 reeds, it's a problem. And others are worried about tying the mat down to the poles, because if you don't, it's going to fly off, it's going to hurt somebody. All those five things, to me, are not so terrible. We can overcome them. We can make it on them. The much bigger problem, to me, is that I'm not completely confident that indeed the people who made these mats, which are created in China, that the person who made the mat had in mind that a frum Jew should use it for schach. My fear is that he followed the vast majority of the mats which are made in China, which are used to stand on, to sleep on, to sit on, all of which are makabel tumas medrash, making an avatuma, which would disqualify it for use as schach. That's the problem which bothers me. Now, of course, there are certain rabbanim who give hashkacha, and even kashrus agencies give hashkacha to sukkah mats. And I spoke to a few of them on Erev Shabbos. And there are a number of different svaras to be makel. Some say that even if the worker doesn't appreciate the fact that this is different than the other stuff he's making the rest of the year, which is likely for the purposes I told you about, sitting, standing, or walking, which is the majority of the mats made in China, apparently, would he have a different machshava, a different thought process if he's told that this is for Orthodox Jews for their sukkah mats? But it's hard to know if he understands what we're talking about. One of the rabbis said he put up a sign in Chinese. Many Chinese are illiterate. It's not clear that he'd even be able to read the Chinese. It's not clear what kind of instructions he'd be given by the owner or by the foreman. It's not clear. So there are two other approaches found in the Sefer called Mekadesh Yisrael by Rabbi Harfenis from Williamsburg. One is based on the Rav of Yerushalayim, who says it depends upon the owner, not upon the worker. Presumably the owner is a bit more sophisticated, understands English, we hope. And when the rabbi comes and the people from America or Israel come, they explain to him and he understands what it's about. And it's his understanding which is determinant and not that of the workers. And this Rabbi Zarger from Yerushalayim says, it's Muchach b'shas v'kama mekomos. I haven't yet figured out where in Shas it's provable. And this Rav Harfen goes further and says, according to the Alta Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, as long as the person buys it for the purpose of schach, it's good enough. Doesn't matter what it was made for. That's not how I read the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. I read it that's true in a case where there are many purposes to build, to make these bamboo mats. Many purposes. You can do it for A, B, and C. A and B are good, and C is no good. So then there's a question how to use it. The Russians are not happy about it because it's kind of a maris ayin. But there's no automatic disqualification if there are three uses, each one is one third. The Tosas Rit seems to say, Piskei Rit and Mesechta Sukkah. However, the mats that are used, again, apparently the preponderant majority is used for medrash, for sleeping, walking, or sitting. Then the way I read the Shulchan Aruch Rav, and I believe the Chalkas Yaakov read it the same way, it doesn't say that. It says that may not work. It may not work in such a case. In a stomach case, the makshava of the purchaser determines, because that's when it begins. Until then, it's just totally nondescript. But if it's a city with or a country or a province where the vast majority are made for mats to sit on, stand on, and walk on, which I think is in fact the case, it's not clear to me at all that it depends upon the owner and not upon the person who's actually making it. And most people who make it, as I said before, are quite primitive. It's hard to be guaranteed that they don't mean to make it as other mats are made in China to sit on, stand on, or walk on. Therefore, it seems to me that it's better to avoid the mats. And the Shebet Alevi says that even though, technically speaking, we can find a way around the mats, it's inconsistent with the Minhag Yisrael from before. We should maintain the old-time Minhagim and use either bamboo poles or simple foliage. That's a better way to do it. According to Tzitz Eliezer, it's possible even b'di'evet, writing in Israel, I think in the 1960s, when many of the Edota Mizrach used to use these mats for that purpose. Today, I believe if it's made in Israel, it would be good. If it's made in America, it would be good. But made in China, again, according to my understanding, is not completely clear what the facts are in China. I'd be afraid to rely upon what's being represented. So we try again to avoid it. On the other hand, I'm cognizant of the fact that the minhag is to be lenient, and the hope is that the mashkichim will go from the various agencies or companies can ascertain to the best of their ability to explain to the workers that it's made for a schach and not for a mat to sit, sleep, or lie on. I feel much better. One of the companies apparently makes the mat in a way which they have full bamboo poles every number of inches, and this way it makes it very uncomfortable to sleep on. Even to sit on, even to walk on would be uncomfortable because of this one pole that sticks up every 6 or 9 inches. That would certainly be a preferred mat. I haven't seen those mats. That's preferred to the ones that I've seen, which are completely flat and roll flat, which you can certainly lie down on or walk on or sit on. That's a problem. Again, the minhag is to be made on the assumption that the workers or the owner or the buyer, whoever you need, has in mind for sichuch, but those facts and or halachas are still somewhat questionable. So in my opinion, it's better to avoid, but I'm cognizant of the fact that in the last 50-something years since the Tzitz Eliezer was so much against it, he said, I'm against it because if you don't oppose it, it's going to become very popular. So his prediction came true. It became very popular in Eretz Yisrael. It's almost universal. And we hope that they make sure to see to it that's made l'shem sichuch, in which case the other problems, I believe, are relatively minor, and then such a bamboo mat can be used. Question number 12. The shul purchases extra abramina to be shared by those who have not purchased one. What should be done on the first day of the chag so that one is kona the set? Now the first bala bayit is finished using the set. What does the next bala bayit do when he takes it from him? That's an excellent question. You have to explain to the balabatim that you need shalachem on the first day. Has to belong to you. Ideally, each and every one should have kavana to acquire it financially when he picks it up and to transfer it financially to the person to whom he gives it or to the community to whom he gives it. This is what should be done. In the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Tov Reish Nun Ches Sif Tes, it says, if there's a community esrog, Mistama have a kapir shusha kol hakol nosim chelkam lechol mishi etlenu losses ba amanashi yachziru lahem. In other words, there's an understanding, an implied understanding that everybody acquires it when they are holding on to the oath of the mitzvah, on the condition that they give it back when they're finished. Not everyone agrees to that. Look at Mishnah Berurah, Sivkot, and Lama Tess and Mem. And therefore, it's preferred to tell the Balabatim that they should have intention to acquire it and later intention to transfer it in the financial sense. Question number 13. Can one set up and put together the Arba Minim on Yom Tov? What is recommended to preserve the Das and Ravas in freshness? Fridge, roots, and water, spray water on them. The second question, I will claim ignorance. Every single person has their own way of keeping the Arba Minim, specifically the Hadassah and the Ravas, fresh. What I do anecdotally, is I just put them in a plastic, which is commonly used, and then wrap it in the plastic and put it in those long cases that we have, and hope that it stays. Often I need to switch them, the Hadassah and the Ravas, towards the end of Sukkos, not always, as the case may be. Everyone has different cheshbonos. Some put it in a wet surface, some put it in the fridge. These days, kosher Hadassah and Ravas are not as hard to get as they used to be. If a person buys a spare set, it really can't hurt. So I can't claim to have any magical formula to preserve their freshness. If what you did last year worked, do it again. The first part, you may put together Arba Minim on Yom Tov. These days, the way you put it together is what we call a koshetl. It's a receptacle, but you don't really tie it. There's a big question, how does that work? You're supposed to tie it. You're supposed to have a kesher. So there are all kinds of answers to that question, but the bottom line is that most people do not tie knots on their lulav, and therefore it's be mutter on Yom Tov. If you do tie a knot, which maybe it's even preferable, you should make sure to tie the knot, it's a double knot, to tie it before Yom Tov. Question number 14. A Megabe whose shul is not a rabbi, can an oval in his shana walk around for a shanas? If not, can he take out the Torah from the Aron for a shanas? Is there a difference? A tremendous difference. The meaning we have is that the oval does not go around. Siman Tov Reish Samach Siv Beis, but he does take the Torah and stands in the middle. This is true all 12 months for someone who lost a parent. That is our very, very prevalent minik. B, what is halacha regarding a Kohen duchening if he is in the Zira of Avelis? What if he's the only Kohen? That's a good question. If you look in Simon Kuf Chav Ches, the Mechaber says, you do duchen in avelus. The Ramah says you do not duchen in avelus. You should walk out before it say. Unless if you're the only Kohen, the Mishnah Berurah of Kotten, Kufnun Tezer, if you're the only Kohen, then you should actually stay to in order to duchen. There are many Ashkenazim who follow the minig of the Mechaber. And that Kohen does duchen within 12 months. And Nitei Gavriel, Zichos Avelus, Chelik Beis, Pergolam Advav talks about it. He says, well, he's discussing Avelus with Farhesya. That's why you should duchen. To me, that's not a compelling argument. We generally assume that the Avelus of Yud Beis Kodesh we do practice. Even with Farhesya, people move their seats and stay in the moved seat. Farhesya, people don't shave, which is for 30 days on Shabbos, even though that's also Farhesya, and the Pashto is 12 months is simply an extension of the 30 days. That argument is not so compelling, Nanias Daiti, but Easter doesn't even begin. That's the best argument. There's no Easter for an Oval to Duchen. That's what the Mechaber says. Some say that in Eretz Yisrael, where they Duchen every day, no, so they shouldn't be duchen. But in America, they duchen only on Yontif, and on Yontif you're supposed to be Masiach Das from the Avelos and conduct yourself Pesimcha, then you should duchen. They quote said the Brisker of Paskind that even Eretz Yisrael, that the Kohen Ovel should duchen. It seems to me that's a preferred minig to be Mekayim and Mitzvah Sasei. So unless the Kohen has a specific minig, or the Shul has a specific minig, they shouldn't duchen. Seems we had the brisker of stock, as it's quoted, and some Hasidic circles do the same thing. It's better to do it than not to, but again, if it's a minute kavua to the contrary, you have to follow the minute. Question number 15. Discuss what things to look for in an esrog, what things may be problematic. That's, of course, we can speak for hours about that. But the most important thing about an esrog is there should be an esrog. Rav Soloveitchik would tell a story that someone came to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and asked him, where does it say in the Shulchan Aruch that an esrog ha-murkov, which is grafted with another fruit, is puzzle? It never says it. So Rav Moshe Zatzal opened the Shulchan Aruch and pointed to the first word, esrog. If it's a murkov, if it's a hybrid, it's a result of grafting two different fruits together, let's say an esrog and a lemon, which is the most common thing, then it's not an esrog in the first place. However, there's a big dispute here. How do you define this exactly? The Chazon Ish seems to say that if they ever was any kind of grafting onto this tree, ever, it's not a purebred esrog. And therefore we should have to avoid using it. Even in the classic case in which the grafting is done not to change the DNA, if you will, of the esrog, but rather simply to strengthen the tree. Esrog trees are notoriously weak. If you graft another citrus, it may strengthen the branch but have no impact on the esrog fruit itself. Chazon Ish said it's no good. No good. He went to great lengths to try to find a kosher esrog which is not grafted at all. He found one apparently somewhere near Tzfat, and a number of different branches came out of that, the Lefkowitz branch and maybe the Braverman branch, which came from a different part of a certain remote Arab town somewhere where there was no tampering. That's what the people should use. And if you ask me, it's best to use those because that has the best yichus, if you will. And the best yichus is the most important thing. It should be an esrog. For what kind of esrog? It has to be an esrog. But the Minhag Yisrael like the Badatz, and they assume that if it looks like an esrog and smells like an esrog and feels like an esrog, it is an esrog. Because any grafting was probably just to strengthen the tree. It shouldn't collapse, but it doesn't impact the very DNA, if you will, of the esrog fruit. And that's what's typically used by most people today, or not makpid on the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish is very difficult, because if he's right, how can you be sure that this fruit had no grafting since Sheshes Yemei Bereshis? According to that, logically it should be no good. The Minhag is to be Meiko, but again, I think it's better to be Machmir. If you're buying the Chazon Ish type, number one, you're probably buying it from Eretz Yisrael. It's always good to buy from Eretz Yisrael, both for Chibas Oretz and for the economy in Eretz Yisrael. Most Chazon Ish have no pitim, but it's kosher. We assume it's no pitim, it's kosher, because the pitim fell off very, very early in the growth process. Not everyone agrees to that, but we assume that is true. Before the shear of an esrog, it presumably fell off. So we assume it's good. If the ukas falls off, or if the pitim falls off at a later stage, certainly after it's been detached from the ground, that is no good. The biggest dispute, perhaps, in esrog is green esrog. Some love green estrogen because it's so fresh, it's so nice, but I don't agree to that. I think a person should avoid dark green estrogen. It's called Yara Kakarsi, like leek. Some of you may have had leek on your tables in Rosh Hashanah. You know what leek was? A dark green. In my view, it's preferred to be machmer, like the Mishkanes Yaakov and the Ochaner, who say that green is no good. The Mishnah said so, the Gemara said so, but some say, no, it's only if it's not ripe yet. Here it is ripe. It will ripen. It's a whole discussion. Others say it's no good because it's not harder, not pretty if it's green. It has to be yellow. So we assume if it's not a dark green, we can be mekel. It's considered to be treated as yellow. The yellow was the better. But if it's green, like green grass, or darker green, I believe it's better to avoid it. even though it looks very nice and it comes from good stock, good yichus, I think we should try to avoid green esrog. Obviously, we should try to find a clean esrog, what we call. Shouldn't be too many dots. Usually, these dots are just plain dirt, and even if not too small, they were not really visible at first glance. You look at an esrog at arm's length, not next to your eyes, and therefore, it's probably permissible. It's better to remove the specks of dirt by someone who knows what he's doing, not to make a hole in the esrog. Final question is question number 16. What are the guidelines when someone goes to work on Chol HaMoed? Is a lawyer reviewing documents considered a Ma'aseh Uman? What if an accountant looking over the accounts? A CFO, a financial planner work on business models and stock information? All good questions. The only headset to go to work is a Dover HaOved. You're going to lose something by not going to work. Not you're not going to gain, you're going to lose. Now, if you're an employee, you can be fired. That's a major Dover HaOved, even though those who want it are considered to be Menias HaRevach. You're just not gaining tomorrow's salary. We don't view it that way. Right now, you already have a job. So even though you're not going to get paid until you work an extra week later, we consider that to be a Dover HaOved, and if you're going to be fired by your employer, you're allowed to go to work on Chol HaMoed. Now, if it's a Tircha Yisera, it's a very great exertion, you shouldn't work on Chol HaMoed. Most of our jobs here are desk jobs. Don't have such a tremendous Tircha Yisera. If you're in construction business, you shouldn't be building on Chol HaMoed at all. Nor should you do work on Chol HaMoed, which you call Mechavein Melachto LeMoed. You plan in advance to do it on Chol HaMoed. That's not right. It's in Tav Kuf Lamed Chesef Aleph and Beis. You really shouldn't do that. There's a machlokes. Must you take a vacation dafka in the week of Chol HaMoed? Or may you take a vacation in the summertime when it's much more convenient, the kids are off and have to go on a trip, da-da-da-da. So Rav Moshe is making on that shayla. And others are machmer. I think Rav Sternberg is machmer more than Muzmanim. Chelik Dalet Simen Shin Aleph, the minigas of Rav Moshe. And take a vacation whenever it's best for the family. Even as a result of that, you're going to have to go into work on Chol HaMoed. That seems to be an accepted psak, although again, it's not unanimously accepted. Now, we talk about a Maisa Uman. That was the question. A Maisa Uman is only permissible for a Hefset Gadol. That's the Mishnah Berurah Siman Tav Kuf members of Cotton Bays. Maybe he has no Hefset Gadol. The source of Maisa Uman is two things. He's looking at Shulchan Aruch there. And you'll see, right, talking about sewing, and we're talking about building. And these two, what you do with your own hands changes dramatically if you're an Uman. That's what's called, in my opinion, a Ma'aseh Uman. However, a lawyer doesn't do anything with his hands. He just reads, and he types into a laptop, and talks on the phone. Those are not Ma'aseh Uman. It's true, he spent years going to law school to be able to acquire the expertise to know what to do. That is all true. But that has nothing to do with what he's doing with his hands. And I don't consider that to be, therefore, a Ma'aseh Uman at all. So therefore, it was a Hefset Ragil, which means not too small, not too big, and it was a Suffolk Hefset Ragil. The Poskim say that it's okay, a Suffolk, Dover of it, and the Belocha in Tav Kuf Lamed Ches Sif Aleph, and Beis talks about it over there, and Tav Kuf Lamed Zayin Sif Tezayin. Suffolk, Dover of it is also allows you to do Melocha. But if it's a Hefset Cotton Ma'od, Mr. Ruhr writes in Tav Kuf Lamed Vav Sif Cotton Yud, that doesn't help. I'm not sure it depends how you find these things, but upon your net worth, how you define these various categories. Therefore, it seems to me that the lawyer or the accountant or the CFO, whatever expertise they have came from their earlier training, not that what they're doing. They're reading a document the same as everybody else reads a document. I don't consider that to be in the category of a Ma'aseh Uman, and therefore if it's a Hefset Ragil, not too small, it's permissible, there would be no need for a Hefset Gadol Ma'od, which is required for an actual Ma'aseh Uman. I want to wish everybody a Gemar Chasima Tova.
Rabbi, wish you a Gemar Chasima Tova and to all the Rabbanim, and thank them for being on the call. Bezrat Hashem, we hope we can call on Rabbi again after Sukkot. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.